everyone, and welcome to episode 18 of the Well and Well podcast. I am bringing you this intro from sunny Tenerife, where I am here with five of my girlfriends. We're on a nice 7-day holiday. We haven't been on a girls' holiday for a while, so it's just really chill. Like, it's super sunny here, and I'm just looking forward to spending 7 days with my best friends before I fly out to Australia. So some of you might know that I'm moving to Bali. But first of all, I'm going to Australia to see my parents because they live there. So I'm just going to spend 2 weeks with them. But yes, it's kind of scary, like the long flights coming up, and I've got my one-way ticket and it's very, very soon. But I'm so grateful that I've got this week to spend with my best friends as a great send-off before I go. So yes. But yeah, I'll give you a little insight to my last week. It's all been pretty hectic. So at the start of the week, I moved out of my flat with one of my best friends, Lucy. And that was pretty hectic because it was unfurnished when we got the flat. So all the furniture was ours and we just needed to get rid of it all. So I spent a lot of my time on Gumtree. Luckily, we managed to do that. And I just realized when I was packing up my room how much shit I had. I didn't think I was a hoarder, but perhaps I was. And I just like the exercise of clearing out so much stuff. Like, I didn't really have any other choice. I had to be ruthless because I've only got 30 kilos to take on this flight down to Australia. And packing up my stuff, I was like, oh my God, Susie, this is ridiculous. The little charity shop on my road is definitely full of all my clothes. But really, once I'd had the clear out, it's such a good exercise to do that. Like, it kind of even made me sort of feel a bit more relaxed in my mind as well. So I'd suggest to any of you if you're feeling a bit stressed out, go and clear out your room, go and clear out your stuff and just get rid of all the crap that you haven't used. I was just sort of thinking, I've got clothes here that have the labels on, I haven't even worn them. Like, if you haven't worn them in the last 12 months, when are you going to wear them? So save the children, we'll benefit from those. But yeah, just, it's like really hectic to try and organize and condense all your life's belongings into 30 kilos. And actually, I didn't do it, to be honest. I was like, I've definitely got 2 bags worth. So I managed to find a courier service and sent a bag over to my sister in Perth. But yeah, the organization was a bit crazy. You also find if you're moving abroad, a lot of people are like, I mean, it's lovely. A lot of people are like, I need to see you before you go. But for some reason, that always just happens on the last 7 days where it's really, really hectic and hard to squeeze people in. But yeah, I had a lot of lunches, a little catch-up tea breaks with people, so that was really good. And then on the last day before I flew here to Tenerife, I unfortunately dropped my purse and lost my cards. So that was the worst timing at first, but just classic, isn't it? So I was just like, look, worst things could have happened, Susie, just chill out, you don't need to worry about it, just block the cards, order some new ones, it's fine. But it's just classic, isn't it? But yeah, I'm just really excited now. Like, it was pretty hectic and stressful last week trying to organize all the stuff, but now I'm here, I'm in Tenerife with my best friends for a week before I go, and I'm just feeling relaxed and super grateful for that now. But yeah, I think the most stressful thing of leaving London was organizing all my stuff. So yeah, I would say definitely to everybody who's thinking about moving abroad, the clear out thing, don't underestimate it, put it that way. But yeah, I'm so grateful and I'm looking forward to this week now. I'm starting to feel just really excited, like allowing myself to be excited now, because I think leading up to leaving London just took so much organization that I almost couldn't look forward or allow myself to be really excited because I was just so concentrating so much of my energy on all the organization and meeting people before I leave and stuff like that. So now really looking forward to it. It's a bit nerve-wracking, but definitely the right thing to do, and I just can't wait to get out there. But this week's episode is super exciting. The founder I've got on is Rosie Cook, and she's founded a transformational swimwear brand called Deakin and Blue. I just love that name. I think it's so cute. But Rosie spent many years as a consultant for Deloitte before entering the world of entrepreneurship and building her swimwear brand. She's super, super smart and switched on, and I really, really enjoyed chatting to her. And also, it was nice to kind of understand that she kind of utilized her skill set that she learned through her years in consulting towards building her brand, and that was kind of nice, because sometimes we can think, oh, we've been wasting our time a little bit in these corporate jobs if that's not what we want to do. But actually, we need to remember that we're learning so many skills that we can actually put towards building a business or building a brand as well. It's not kind of lost time, if that makes sense. About Rosie's brand. So Rosie spotted a gap in the market for swimwear that basically looked good but was functional for the local leisure centre. Because if you think about it, us girls, we have this trouble where you've got sort of skimpy bikinis that you'd wear on holiday, ordering cocktails at the hotel or a beach club or whatever. But then you're not really going to want to wear those to the local leisure centre. One, it doesn't really feel appropriate. But two, they're not very stable if you're going for like a hardcore sort of swimming session. So the alternatives on the market are like quite hardcore sort of sporty, like Speedo type swimwear that some girls just don't particularly like. You just don't feel very feminine in it. So Rosie kind of spotted that gap in the market and decided to design some swimwear that fitted that niche. And I just love that idea. It really, really resonates. So we chatted a bit around how she grew the brand and things like that. And she also gives a lot of tips for aspiring entrepreneurs, especially in a product-based business. So if you've got some sort of idea, she goes into detail about the tips of the first sort of action steps that you can take towards starting to take action on the idea. So it's a really great conversation. I hope you enjoy it. I'd be very grateful if you could hit subscribe on whatever platform you're using. That way, next time I release a podcast, you'll automatically download it and you'll be notified so you won't miss any. But thank you so much for listening, and please enjoy this episode. Welcome, Rosie. Thank you so much for coming on. How was your weekend?
Oh, lovely. Thank you. I had a very restorative weekend. Thank you. How about you?
Yeah, it was great. Thanks. Pretty chill. It was a good one. So Rosie, I'd love it if you could start by introducing yourself to the listeners.
Absolutely. So I'm Rosie Cook. I'm the founder of Deakin and Blue. We're a transformational women's swimwear brand. So we're on a mission to help women feel amazing in a swimsuit, whatever their shape or size. And we're doing that because we believe the swimwear industry is in need of some reinvention, that products are either pretty or functional, that they're not designed with female body shape in mind, and that the industry is fundamentally unsustainable. So I've been running that business for coming up for 3 years. We launched in July 2017. But before setting up that business, I worked in the city for 6 years in strategy consulting. So made a kind of leap from the corporate world to creative fashion manufacturing. So it's been an exciting adventure so far.
Yeah, and I'm so excited to go into a little bit more detail about the brand and how you kind of made that leap as well. All good. So we'll start at the start then. So your decision to go into consulting as a graduate, what were your kind of reasons behind this? Because everyone has all different reasons as to why they started in the corporate world. Some people fell into it. Some people, you know, had the intention of going in or got inspired by their parents. What was kind of your decision to go into consulting initially?
Yeah, it was a very deliberate decision for me. So I studied English at Cambridge and wasn't sure what I wanted from a career. But I had always been drawn to sort of problem solving and management sort of opportunities. So, worked on the college JCR, that kind of thing. And I, which is the sort of Students Association. And I knew that I wanted to sort of use my organisational problem solving skills, business skills, as much as my sort of English degree. So in my second year at university, I did an internship with a consulting firm. And just absolutely loved it, loved the way my brain was being used, loved working with really smart people. And so when they offered me a job to start when I graduated, it was a no-brainer. And for me, consulting was, coming from quite a creative background with an English degree, you know, I hadn't touched a calculator since sort of 6 years previously. So consulting represented a really accessible way to enter the business world. It was still quite a creative entry into the business world because it is really about problem solving and lots of blue sky thinking. But it also allowed me to really upskill in areas that were really out of my comfort zone. So understanding how P&L worked or understanding the fundamental levers that a business might have to change direction or grow. And that was really exciting to me because it represented a chance to keep learning. I could earn good money. I could live in the city with my friends, which at 20 absolutely appealed. And it came with, I joined a big firm, and joining them came with a huge sort of social side to it as well. It was, you know, I think 250 of us started at once. So it was like a sort of like Freshers Week all over again. You know, it was joining with a big community of smart and interesting people. So that was a huge part of the draw for me as well.
And I'm really interested as well. I just picked up there. So you said you went to Cambridge, and I'm interested to understand a little bit more around kind of the vibe there in terms of what they not pushed you into, but what you were kind of like supposed to go into at Cambridge, because I've spoken to a variety of guests that went to different unis, and even the one I went to, I did a business degree, and it wasn't kind of, starting a business wasn't like an obvious path that they put in front of you, even though I did a business degree. So it was more about like the big grad schemes, like the big four, the consulting firms, the banks, and that kind of was the most popular choice, and it just felt like the most normal route or what everybody was aiming for. Was it like that at Cambridge, or was it a bit different? Because I'm interested because Cambridge is obviously one of the top unis, so if anywhere's going to push entrepreneurship, you would think that perhaps they would think that they're going to be able to do that, you know?
Absolutely, and I suspect they are doing lots around entrepreneurship, especially now. But that wasn't something that was visible to me at the time, and perhaps, to be honest, I wasn't looking for it. I think at a university like Cambridge, which prides itself on sort of academic excellence, ideally they would be all of the students that study there would go into academia and would be pursuing academic, whether that's academic research, teaching, further. So lots of my university peers are still in academia. And I think that is what the university is incredibly well set up for, if that appeals to you and you have the talent and interest and capability of going on and doing that. That wasn't something that appealed to me. And then there were things like careers fairs where you could go and meet the more typical sort of graduate recruiters, so big companies, the big four and banks and so on, as you mentioned. I actually didn't attend those sorts of things whilst I was there, although I think they were very accessible, and I know lots of people that did. As I say, entrepreneurship wasn't something that was on my radar there, although I'd be amazed if there's not an entrepreneurship society and, you know, all of those kind of things. And certainly over the last sort of 5 years, as entrepreneurship has sort of exploded in the UK, I would suspect they're doing even more around that now. Mm-hmm. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, totally makes sense. Yeah, I think it's interesting. You had an interesting perspective there by when you said it wasn't necessarily visible to you. Perhaps that was the same for me, that I wasn't necessarily looking for it, although I feel like I probably was, given I chose it's a really interesting how it's not presented to you in such a strong way as the graduate schemes, but perhaps it's because it doesn't have a marketing budget behind it.
Yeah, and also, my goodness, I mean, when I look back to university, we had short terms, we were doing a hell of a lot of work, I was busy socialising. Actually, when I look back and think, I also set myself up an internship and got a job whilst I was there, I think, how on earth did I have the time? So I think, you know, we forget that you're living in these very intense bubbles at university, and perhaps not, you simply don't have the time or capacity to go and think about all of those other things as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. Okay, let's go on to your experience of corporate life at Deloitte. So how long were you there, first of all?
I was there about, I can never remember this, I think it was about 5 years in total. About 5 years. Yeah. So joined
That's
as a fresh grad out of university and then worked my way up in their strategy practice.
Okay, nice. I have a couple of friends at Deloitte actually, and they
Okay.
really speak really highly of it.
Yeah.
So what was your experience there and what kind of did you like and didn't like about it?
Well, Deloitte was a fantastic place to work, and I only really have positive things to say about my experience there. It was a big organisation, so lots of opportunity to meet lots of different people, work on lots of different sorts of clients. So I worked in the private sector, and I worked across various different companies, so from media and technology all the way through to pharmaceutical or life sciences companies. And the beauty of working for a big firm like that is, you know, there are lots and lots of opportunities across a wide range of businesses, and that was very much part of the appeal for me. It was very structured, which was fantastic because I could learn lots and had a clear sense of where I was going. And I found the work really intellectually stimulating. So solving real problems for big firms that I'd heard of, you know, firms that you'd read about in the paper. And so that was really exciting, and I felt like I could have an impact. I think where for me there were gaps were around wanting to feel more connected to the outcome of my work. So, and this is something that's more a comment on consultancy than on Deloitte per se, but
right.
when you're working in consulting, what you're doing effectively is advising the C-suite team, so the chief exec and whoever their key advisors are, whether that's the CFO or and the chief strategic officer, you're advising them on and it helping present them with information for them to make a decision, but you're never actually making that decision and never actually having to then go and execute or see that set of decisions through to an outcome. And so I firstly wanted to feel much more connected to the sort of output of what I was helping recommend. But also there was this sort of sense of fulfillment and purpose, and I think partly a product of working for a very big organization, feeling like you were sort of a cog in the machine rather than having real human impact. So there were some challenges around that and sort of a sense, lacking a sense of purpose. And then finally, I think for me, you know, whilst I was 25, I didn't mind working sort of, you know, 14, 15 hour days and being in New York one week and Sheffield the next and Coventry the week after. And, you know, that sort of could work with being a young 20 year old that was sort of selfish and independent. But as I started thinking about, you know, I got more serious with my partner, looked ahead and thought I might want a family in the future, I struggled to see how that way of life could balance with all of the other aspirations I had for myself, which were outside of a career. And what I didn't want to do was pick a career that felt it was compromising on sort of intellectual stimulation or, you know, I didn't want to opt out of something really thrilling. But at the same time, you can't have children and in my view, it's tricky to have children and a partner and, you know, be out of the country 5 days a week. So I suppose I looked around me and looked up for role models that had nailed that and felt I couldn't find anyone that had got that quite right for what I wanted. So started looking for different sorts of roles in different sorts of organisations that might be able to use my very sort of corporate commercial skill set, but in a very different environment. And so then that was when I made the shift into the startup world, joining a small team in the digital recruitment space. There were about 10 of us, I think, when we joined, maybe 8 or 10 of us. So it was a complete change of size of team, the sort of, you know, numbers that you're dealing with, the problems that you're dealing with. I joined as head of operations, and my role involved everything from sort of management for P&L delivery for the business, which was very exciting, but also, you know, ordering the kitchen roll. So it was like the complete spectrum, which was amazing for me and a brilliant introduction to the startup world, because it's that wouldn't be for everyone. And that really helped me to realize that actually I loved working in a small dynamic team where you had complete oversight of everything going on in the business, and you could make really exciting decisions in a really agile way. So that's an amazing sort of, testing ground for me, I suppose.
Yeah, no, that's so interesting. And so much of that resonates with me. And I just want to jump back to the point where you said you looked kind of to the more senior people in the organization at Deloitte, and it wasn't kind of necessarily what you wanted. And that's definitely something that happened to me when I worked in banking. I started to realize, okay, this isn't necessarily what I expected, or it's not having the impact on me that I had expected it to have. And yes. Then I kind of thought, what am I striving for here? What's this like ladder for? And then you look at kind of the managing directors around and you're like, okay, if I stayed here for like 20 years or 30 years, that's the aim to be with the firm. That's what I'm working for. And it just hit me like, no, sorry, no, like offense to anything they're doing. Cause it's an incredible achievement to get that kind of title and role at a bank and all that responsibility, but that I just had no interest in that at all.
I think it's not for everyone. And I think being aware of that and working out what you need beyond your sort of immediate intellectual stimulation is so important. And actually what you think you might need at 21 can change so wildly, right?
Yeah.
So I think having the really honest conversation with yourself, which can be hard because if you've come from a perhaps high achieving background where you've always pushed yourself hard, gone for the seemingly most tricky job or the most challenging path, it can feel at odds with that to say, this is no longer enough for me or right for me.
Yeah.
Having those honest sort of self conversations is the starting point of that, definitely.
Exactly. And then when you recognize the end goal isn't necessarily something you want, then that's when sometimes it can just all crash down, like the motivation and stuff like that, I think. So I just pause on this and say to the listeners, if anyone's slightly thinking about their role and questioning what they're doing, a good tip is to go and have a look at someone who's further on in the organization, look at what they're doing and say, okay, is this interesting to me? Is this something I want to strive for?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go on to then this startup decision, because equally I did this too. I was like, right, I'm in banking. Okay. This is a great bank, but the culture just is too corporate for me. Perhaps I need to move to tech. That's where it's at. That's what you're hearing about in the news. Let's go and sit on some beanbags and work on some laptops. And wear jeans to work. So, I totally get it. So what were your kind of intentions and expectations when you chose to move to a startup from a big corporate? Was it similar to that in terms of a culture choice?
Yeah, some of it was
responsibility level.
Some of it was cultural, some of it was responsibility. And I think, you know, when I look back at the things that were missing from my experience in consulting, it was really trying to address those. So it was trying to keep as much of the sort of smart, intelligent, really exciting work within my threshold. But absolutely having more connection to the output of the decisions I was making. So if I was joining a board meeting and making a series of decisions about launching a new product or going after a new market area, to then be part of the team that were driving that activity and making that happen, and to be part of the team that were celebrating at the end of the year when you'd nailed that. So it was more about sort of delivery and execution as well as sort of advising from afar. Some of it was cultural change, and something that had frustrated me for a while in consulting was the lack of control over my own diary. I had become someone that just cancelled dinner with friends or missed theatre appointments or people's birthdays at last minute, or suddenly wasn't around for a weekend because I had to work or I was in another country. And I felt frustrated by the sort of lack of control over my own time and for becoming a flaky friend. part of it was also about knowing that I had a level of responsibility where I'd be working incredibly hard, but if I said I was leaving at 7, I was leaving at 7. And that sort of level of autonomy was important to me because of where I was in my life and what I needed at that time as well. So it was a mix of culture and sort of role change as well.
And was it, so when you had those intentions and expectations, did it turn out to be what you expected in terms of the culture and the responsibility level?
Yeah, I think it did. And I mean, the process that I went through to identify the team that I wanted to join and the business I wanted to join was, I mean, you hear people say this, and I can't stress enough how important it is, but for me, interview processes are just so two-way. And for me, that process was as much about me saying, is this somewhere I want to work? Is this a team I feel I kind of emotionally and intellectually connect with? Is it an environment that I want to find myself in? And when they made me an offer, I had a series of follow-up conversations that I wanted to have before I was willing to sort of accept. So I had done a lot of sort of due diligence, if you like, before I accepted that role. And I think there are a lot of startups or a lot of organizations I could have gone into that would have been completely wrong. But actually, this was a brilliant team doing brilliant work that I was really excited to be a part of. So it very much met my expectations in that sense.
Mm-hmm. I kind of had a similar experience as well. Looking back on it now, like starting a business, I think it was such a good decision to have that startup phase. And I think the reason why is because as a graduate, and I don't know if you felt this, but on the graduate scheme, you kind of are protected by this golden wrapper of like, you are on the grad scheme. They literally sort of act like you're, I don't know, future leaders and stuff like this, and you're kind of protected by that brand. And then my experience of coming out of it was, okay, you absolutely have no protection, you're just another person, like no one gives a shit. You know what
and,
I mean,
and if you screw up, it's your fault, you know. Absolutely. Scary, right?
Yeah, and I didn't realize I had been in that bubble until I felt really vulnerable.
That's such a great point. A great point. I really agree with that.
And I think, so if anyone is listening, again, I'll like put this back to the listeners, and they would love to have a business one day, but they don't quite feel ready and they're working in a big corporate, a really good step is to go and find a role at a startup where perhaps it's not necessarily a startup with 10 people, but they're entering a new market or something where you have a role where you can build something of your own. You're not protected. You almost have to put yourself out there a bit, be vulnerable, because that is a really good practice for the real business world. And unfortunately, you can't really get the same experience at a big corporate just because of the nature of the business. Would you agree with that?
I would. I mean, I think it's always worth looking internally where you are in case they have an adjacent team or set of opportunities that excite you. But for that complete sort of 180 change of direction in terms of exposure, being out of your comfort zone, then yes, I think joining a startup is a completely different environment. And I think actually if you join a startup that's in a sector or as you say, an industry that's relevant to what you want to go into, then chances are you'll be building your network, your skills, your sort of area expertise as well. So actually that's a really brilliant idea for sort of upskilling yourself before you take the big leap. Anyway, so yes, I can't agree more that that's a really great and safe way of testing whether that world is for you and building your network at the same time, definitely.
Okay, let's move on to noticing a gap in the market for swimwear and how that happened. And I guess, so you were at the startup at this time, right? So
yeah, I was.
Let's talk a little about this phase.
So I started swimming for exercise, and I loved the idea of adding a swim to my sort of weekly workout routine because I went to the gym a lot and did a lot of classes and ran, but always was sort of very connected with those activities. So, you know, would log a workout or would be looking at the data of my runs and that kind of thing. And I loved the idea, having come from a very busy intensity role and then a very busy intense in a different way startup role, I loved the idea of a swim being an hour without my phone, without email or WhatsApp notifications. So a workout that was as much for my brain as for my body. Mm-hmm. And went to buy a swimsuit for my weekly swim because I own lots of lovely skimpy bikinis, which are wonderful on holiday. Amazing for ordering cocktails in, but not really leisure centre appropriate. And also probably certainly wouldn't survive a tumble turn or a dive into the pool. So I wanted something that would stay in place, would be comfortable and not sort of disintegrate when I sort of put it in chlorine three times a week, but also something that was flattering, that thought about my body shape. I'm slim but curvy, so I wanted something that offered enough bust support and coverage and that didn't just sort of flatten my boobs to my chest. And I wanted it to not compromise on style. I, you know, when I go to the gym, I have really flattering sort of performance-based kit that is, you know, sweat-wicking, lightweight, breathable, and all those things, but also looks and feels great. And I wanted something similar for the pool. And at the time, I couldn't find anything. And I was really surprised. And I realized the swimwear market's so divided here. There's holiday swim, which is skimpy, yeah. And super, super serious sports swimwear, which is black and unforgivably thin and has no, doesn't acknowledge that women might have different body shapes. So at the time, I tacked a sports bra into a high street swimsuit and adjusted
them.
Yeah, I'm not a seamstress, so it didn't look amazing, I'll be honest. And the reason I don't sew our products today.
I love that initiative.
I know, I did. But I wanted to see, can I make something that is so much better than anything else I can find? And I realized in that product that I was standing taller, my shoulders were relaxed, I felt more comfortable. And then when I went for a swim, I was just thinking about my swim and I didn't have to worry about hoiking my suit out of my bum or my boobs falling out of the suit or anything else. So I felt for a while that this product, that this problem was just something that I had. And I think as women, we often assume the problem is to do with us. You know, it's my body, it's my wide hips, it's my big bum, it's my silly waist. But I told girlfriends about this for sort of months, that I'd made this swimsuit and I was swimming in it in public. And every woman that I told, whatever her shape, size, age, had her own swimwear gripe. So I realized there was something here, and sort of using my consulting skills, started looking at this as a marketplace and, or as a market rather, and quickly came across a couple of really sobering stats. So the first, that 500,000 women have given up swimming because of the thought of putting on a swimsuit.
Wow.
I mean, that's just in England alone in the last 10 years. And so like kit is stopping women from doing the thing they love. And the second stat was that 1 in 2 mums don't take their child to learn to swim, again, because of body image concerns.
One in two.
A really crazy stat. And learning to swim isn't like learning to play tennis, right? It's not a sort of nice middle class luxury. It's a life skill.
Yes, you, survival.
You need to know how to cope in water should you find yourself in it. So I was really shocked by those stats. And I think we're living in an age where kit still stops women from participating in sport and life every day. It was just earlier this year that you might have read NASA had planned an all-women space mission. They didn't have the spacesuit in the right size, so the woman was pulled and a guy was sent in her place.
Oh my God, no, but that makes me so angry.
Same. And it's
how has that happened?
And it's laughably bad. I mean, it's almost comic, but it's not comic. It's true.
No. Yeah. Oh, that's so depressing.
Frustrating because, you know, to get women into positions where they're able to compete with men has involved overcoming a number of obstacles. So the final hurdle to then be stopped by lack of kit is so frustrating.
I mean, I think, yeah, on that point, it's almost like, okay, it's been like that for so long that we can understand in society that things are kind of made towards the male situation. However, the big problem with that, though, is that they realized that and then didn't care and then replaced it with a man. They should then acknowledge, okay, well, this isn't right, we've got more women coming through, let's make one for a woman, you know. That I feel like that's the worst thing about that. The
solution itself almost is problematic. Deacon & Blue today, I suppose, is a business. Well, Deacon & Blue today is a business which is setting out to create the kit that helps women to participate in sport and life. And we've started with swimwear, so we've started by reinventing swimwear. But we see the broader bodywear market as very much something that we're keen to sort of get our teeth into, because I think it's not just swimwear that stops women from participating in sport and life. There are lots of other areas too. And we're not going to be designing spacesuits, but, you know, the NASA example comes to mind easily.
Yeah, I totally agree with your point. And we chatted about this before, and my own experience of joining the gym down the road, and there's a nice swimming pool there with a jacuzzi. Oh. Granted, I probably use it more for the jacuzzi than anything. But originally when I first joined, I was thinking, right, let's go and have a little dip in the jacuzzi after my gym class or whatever. And I was like, God, what do I wear? I can't wear any of these bikinis that I wear on holiday. It's far too skimpy for a Virgin Active and what.
Absolutely. You know?
And then I go online and have a look at what there is out there, and just the alternatives are just so ugly that I just wouldn't even want to get in that either. So there's just nothing in the middle that suits that kind of British gym environment rather than like a beautiful beach on holiday.
I so agree.
I really think you've like hit such a good niche there.
Thank you.
Okay, so at this point then, you're starting to use your consultant hat, thinking about this as being a brand and a business and a like problem you can solve. How did you think about yourself becoming a business owner? Was that kind of something that scared you, something you wanted? Was that kind of mental shift quite easy for you? You just like, yes, I want to do this. This is the idea. I found it kind of thing.
Yeah. It's a good question. I suppose I had thought for a while that I might like to run my own business, and that was part of the thinking that took me into a startup in the first place. But I think really I didn't start thinking about being a business owner until I had already set up the business and was sort of running it, because certainly initially that first set of thinking was really just about, can I create a problem, create a product that solves the problem? And if we do that, then the next step is, can we find the customer to market it to? And the next step is, how do we do that? And how do we monetize it in a way that makes sense? And I suppose I was sort of thinking about each part of the problem in turn, rather than sort of sitting back and thinking, am I ready to run a business? Which perhaps if I'd thought that at the time might have scared me in its own way. But I think because there was such a clear problem that we were solving, that actually took all of my sort of focus. And then once I found myself running the business, it had already been sort of underway for sort of 6+ months. But no, that didn't daunt me once I realized that. I think that was a more straightforward transition. But again, I think probably having worked at the startup helped with that. Gave me sort of visibility of what running a business looked like and what sort of skills you might need.
I can hear that builder now.
Is it
should be all right, I think. There's just a bit of hammering, isn't there?
I know. Honestly, I have to guess.
There's nothing we can do about it. We'll just...
It's been going on for 2 months.
Oh my God.
I don't work from home anymore. I normally work from a WeWork down the road. Podcast recording, I thought we'd better at home, but I completely forgot that this...
No, it's fine. Don't worry. It should be fine. Okay, where was I? I had a question in my head for you.
Oh, yeah. Transition.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so when you then were to start doing this work on the brand, did you have a plan in terms of, right, okay, this is my exit strategy out of this startup to work full time on this? Because I guess there's a couple of considerations with that. There's like financial considerations in terms of getting rid of your income. There is like, am I ready for this mindset stuff? And then sometimes people have different... some people want their business to have built their business to a point whilst they have an income before they leave, and other people would just prefer to go full on into it. Did you have like a plan in place, or did you kind of just go with it?
For me, I found it very, very hard to work on the business sort of at the edge of my desk or at the end of the day. Mm. I was working long hours. I was very... sort of invested in the business I was working for, and I just didn't feel that I could give my own business its due attention by sort of picking it up on a Saturday morning and a Thursday night when I kind of rocked in at 8:30 or whatever. So I took the decision to leave the business I was working for and to give myself a period of months to sort of test out if this was a real problem, if there was a real market here, and if I could create a set of products that would solve that. And I suppose I was in the position, I had some savings from my time in the city. I had a conversation with my husband where we discussed whether we could make that work for a series of months where I didn't earn an income. And we agreed that we could for a period. So I was in a very fortunate position to be able to do it that way. Early on when I was pre-launch, and actually briefly after launch as well, I did some contract consulting work, which was very kind of complimentary because it was a sort of, you know, the sort of work where you'd go in and do a day's work and be paid for the day, but you didn't take it home with you. You didn't think about it all weekend. You could do a sort of week here and a week there, but otherwise, and sort of turn it on and turn it off as needed. And that was quite useful for me because it allowed me to earn some money to help with my personal cash flow, but not have all of the sort of emotional commitment that comes from having a full-time job. And if you're the sort of person that wants to go and set up your own business, chances are whatever your job you're doing, whether it's for yourself or for someone else, you're not the sort of person that gets in at 6 p.m. and just sort of doesn't think about it anymore.
Yeah.
So I found that that was a much easier way of transitioning to sort of say goodbye to the full-time job altogether, kind of dive in at the deep end and give this a go, but having a little bit of part-time contract work on the side as and when needed to sort of help me pay the bill that was coming up or help with a holiday that I wanted to go on. So that worked really well for me. And then that gave me the space and time. And to be honest, the fear that I needed to really drive this business. And I think if I tried to do it on the side, perhaps it would have taken me years to get to a product and years to get to a marketing plan. Whereas actually I started working on it full-time in the September, and we had a working product by the January, and we launched a set of products by the June. So effectively within a 9-month window, we went from is this a concept all the way through to launching a set of products that we sold to market. And I think that accelerated time scale only came because I was sort of going at it full of fear that, you know, I wouldn't be able to pay my mortgage.
Yeah.
So, quite well, actually.
Honestly, that's so refreshing to hear. And I was exactly the same. I was thinking, Susie, you need to just do this on the side. You can't just suddenly go cold turkey. You know, you can't take a risk like that. And I just wasn't working on it because in these startups, you are scraping together for the startup. It drains so much of your energy. And if you want to go to the gym after work or like see friends and stuff, then you literally, it's really, really hard to fit it in. And I totally agree with you. So there's so many ways of doing it. It's either you can do it on the side or you focus on building yourself some savings to kind of be your buffer when you've got no income. But I completely agree with you on the fear factor as well. You almost need that pressure to go at a pace that like turbocharge your pace basically.
Absolutely.
That you couldn't do if you had another job, because you just don't have that pressure because you've got that income coming in.
Absolutely.
It's so refreshing to hear, because you hear a lot about side hustles and it's nice to chat to someone else who like felt that they struggled to do it on the side as well.
Definitely. Yeah, I really did. And I think that worked for me. And it meant I had quite strict deadlines, and it meant that I reviewed it on a, I would say, weekly, monthly basis. I reviewed, is this the right thing to be doing?
Yeah.
Is this sensible? And that was frightening. And it meant that I had to keep asking myself, do I really believe this is going to work? Mm-hmm. But then it forced me to to be developing the product at the speed that we did. So it did work, definitely.
Amazing. And I would also love to ask you, because you have such a great consulting background and you've built this product-based business, do you have any advice for any of the listeners out there who might have an idea for a product-based business, but it's literally just an idea, they haven't really acted on it? What are the first few steps that they could take to kind of explore whether it's a viable idea?
Yeah, I think I read Lean Startup by Eric Ries,
yes,
which is all about minimum viable product. Yes. And that, that sort of school of thinking has informed so much tech and startup, so much of the tech and startup world in general, you almost can't escape it. But it's very popular because it really does work. So I think, and it was exactly the thinking we employed at Deakin and Blue, it was about saying we're not going to spend 3 years building the absolutely most perfect product. We're going to start with something that addresses the most fundamental of the problems and test whether there is an appetite for that. And actually, my real minimum viable product was the sports bra tacked into my swimsuit, right? That was minimum viable product number one, that I was willing to wear in public. That was sort of test case number one. When we were developing the products that we would go on to sell to customers, I had customers involved at every stage of the process. And that sounds lofty and scary, and you don't need to have millions of customers, but you just don't want to be asking your mum and your sister because they will tell you it's bad. So you just need people that are one stage removed who will give you really honest feedback. And it's not enough for them to say they like it and sat around a kitchen table. They have to feel comfortable to wear it in public, for our product at least, and comfortable enough to pay for it. And those were two kind of key tests that we needed sort of proof of before I felt that we had validation that the proposition worked. And so I involved customers who were sort of one step removed from me at every stage of the product development process early on. And we did that really lean and lightweight. This wasn't costing tens of thousands of pounds. You know, it was me and a seamstress and a technical designer. I was asking friends to introduce me to people that I didn't know.
Right, got it.
Running surveys that asked people about problem areas with swimwear and asking them to leave their email address if they were willing to be involved. And then I was picking people that I didn't know that would sit with me, would wear it, and would be completely honest about what they thought. And so I think doing things really lean and really cost efficiently without sort of, you know, having to remortgage your home, an idea that you don't yet know if it works, that's absolutely for me the way to sort of test product. And chances are the first iterations won't be right. And you'll get feedback that the whole thing's completely wrong, and that's okay as well. But you just need to be sort of gathering that and learning from it.
That book is so, I'm remembering it now. I read it about a year ago, like whilst you're talking. It's so impacted me actually. And what you're saying is exactly it. It's all about getting an MVP out, like a minimum viable product, get feedback and iterate from that. Whereas I think a lot of people, and I used to do this with previous ideas, keep it to yourself. You're scared someone's going to steal it.
Yes.
And then try and build it into the perfect thing before you put it out there and get feedback. And that's just so inefficient. Like in reality, if you've just got an idea, no one's going to care. You're not going to ruin your brand because you don't really have a brand. So you might as well just get feedback and get the quickest way to the best product possible.
And if your product can be stolen so easily by someone else knowing about it and copying it, then you don't have a business anyway.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, that's a really great test. You know, if you bring something to market and someone else pips you to the post, then probably you don't have a business because you don't have a sort of moat around the business that protects you. It's really worth doing that. But it's interesting coming from a corporate background, because that sort of approach of, you know, speak to customers before it's perfect and share a product before it's finessed is very anti or into sort of corporate thinking, right? So that was very frightening for me. And I think it was only having worked at a startup where we had done things lean and very agile and very sort of bootstrapped, that I felt comfortable doing that, knowing that that approach was okay and that I wasn't completely mad.
That's such a good point. And I think the reason why it's like that in corporate perhaps is because they've got such a major brand to protect. Whereas as a founder just starting with an idea, you don't have that, so you don't need to necessarily worry. If it fails, you're just still on zero. It doesn't matter. And I think from my own experience, and something that might resonate with you as well, that was difficult to begin with, was so used to making strategic decisions based on data from working in corporate and even at a startup as well. But when you go out on your own and you need to put stuff out there, you don't have any historical data. So sometimes you just have to make a decision based on a guess.
Yes.
It's really, really scary to do that. But over time, you'll start to build up your own data. Is that kind of something that resonates with you?
It is. But I think where you can get data, even at a really small scale, that's so useful. So yeah. I think I set up a survey when I first thought, okay, this is something I want to explore. And it had a series of sort of, you know, questions asking about what are the pain points people have experienced with swimwear, what they paid for their last swimsuit, where they bought it from, and so on. And I shared that with family and friends, and then people shared it more widely. And over the course of, I think it was a weekend, we had about 300 responses, and suddenly that was actually data. Wow. That wasn't 10,000 data points, but 300 was enough to give me an indication, and for that data to be meaningful. I think they say you need sort of 200 to get a real sort of sense of a trend, or for data to be able to extrapolate sort of meaning from something. And so we had absolutely met that, and that gave us real information and insight, and we didn't have to pay a research company or you know, actually we just shared a survey for free via a free platform on social media. So I think you're right, there's a lot of guessing and intuition in those early days, but the moment that you can sort of get data points to qualify or validate your thinking, you, even if that's only helping your confidence, that's a brilliant thing to do, because it gives you more conviction in what you're doing. Actually, in those surveys, I don't think we learned anything we didn't already know, but we felt really, really confident because 300 people agreed with us about a particular pain point, and that was a fantastic sort of validation of our concept.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. There we go. Two tips for people who have product-based idea. Go out and do a survey, test the market, try and get more than 200 responses, and then just go ahead with your MVP and try and get some feedback and iterate from there, and don't try and make it perfect from the start.
Absolutely.
Advice. Okay, so we're kind of coming up to time, but I have a quick fire round to finish. Sure. So, Rosie, what is the best book that you've ever read?
Oh, so I am a huge reader, and honestly, the best book I've ever read would not be a non-fiction book, because I'm a big lover of fiction. But in this context, the most powerful book, I think, for my thinking around Deacon in Blue was Start With Why by Simon Sinek, because that just... it's a book that talks about the reason that you're building a product or a proposition or a service rather than what the product is itself. And it roots all of your thinking in the sort of problem and the mission, the problem you're solving and the mission that you're on. And it's really informed and influenced the way that I think about everything we do in the business. I ask myself, is it related back to this fundamental problem we're trying to solve? So that was a real turning point in my thinking. So Start With Why by Simon Sinek.
That message is so important, that kind of knowing the mission of what you're doing and being passionate about that. 100%.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. I called this podcast the Well and Well podcast because I believe that to be well in life, you need to do some wild things and dare to go against the norm sometimes.
I love it.
So, what is the wildest thing that you've ever done?
I mean, I'm a wild swimmer, so I swim in ponds. So when you say the word wild, that is what immediately comes.
Yeah.
But I'm an adrenaline junkie as well, so I've sort of jumped out of planes and bungee jumped.
Love that.
I probably wouldn't now. I did a lot of those things when I was in my early 20s and clearly had no fear for my mortality. Now those are a bit more frightening. But probably skydiving over Rio is one of the wildest things I've done.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I was going to just ask you where your favourite skydive was. Yeah, wow, Rio, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, very cool. On my 19th
very birthday. Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, what? You're so young. I love that.
I know. So young and so foolish.
Yeah. Nice birthday present.
Yeah.
Okay. And finally, what is the best piece of advice that you've ever been given?
Ah, great. So I went to a talk a couple of years ago and listened to a woman called Sarah Wood, who is the CEO of a media company called Unruly. And she said the best advice she'd ever been given, which she then shared with us, and which has since become the best advice I've ever been given, was that every night as a founder, or indeed as anyone in any business role, you should fire yourself from your job. And in the morning, you should reappoint yourself as the CEO of that job or as the CEO of your business. And what that sort of process does is allows you to come in and look at the landscape anew and not be bogged down or tied up in knots because of things that happened yesterday or things you were working on yesterday. It allows you to check your priorities, to check you're working on the right things, to say, if I was a brand new person coming to this, is this the way that we'd be spending the money, spending our time, sharing our resources? And it's so powerful, because I think when I've been stuck in the business working on something, or been struggling to make something work, that thinking has really allowed me to step back and look at the landscape and think, actually, what we're working on isn't important enough. If I was a new CEO coming in here, the key priority would be that, and that's what we should be doing. So it's quite an empowering piece of advice, because it gives you permission to change tack, to check what you're doing, and to allocate your time and money in the best possible way. And that's really exciting and really empowering, I think.
That's amazing. I've never heard that before, but such a good idea, because I guess it helps you look at things like completely objectively, rather than sometimes when you're working on something for so long, you get, like emotionally invested in stuff, or sometimes you just even lose the perspective of all the choices. So yeah, that's really, really interesting. Amazing. So where can the listeners stay up to date with you and Deakin and Blue?
Brilliant. So Deakin and Blue is online at www.deakinandblue.com, and we're on all social media channels. Deakin and Blue is our handle across all of them, and we're most active on Instagram. So there we take people behind the scenes, we take them into our production studio and show them how fabrics are made and so on. So that's the best place to stay in touch with the business. And then I'm on LinkedIn, and anyone that has any questions or wants to connect is very welcome to do so. It's Rosie Cook.
Perfect. And I'll link all of that in the show notes as well, so people can just click on them. But thank you so much, Rosie, for coming on. That was really, really great. Enjoyed it. That's the end of the episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Rosie has some really great insights, and I really enjoyed her story. And I think the brand that she's building is amazing, and the work that she's doing is great. So definitely go and check out all her links. They're all in the show notes. And remember to hit subscribe so that you don't miss any future episodes. And I'll be back with you next week. Thank you so much for listening.